Welcome to the Fallout Lorecast, the podcast that explores the boundaries of our knowledge about the world of Fallout. Wastelanders and Vault Dwellers, welcome back to the Fallout Lorecast. This week's episode of the Fallout TV show, episode 5, season 2, is one of the most interesting episodes we've had yet, with a really close look at Freeside, which is a location many of us know very well from Fallout New Vegas. And there are all sorts of plot twists and turns, things that are revealed, and little details that I picked up on that many of you might have noticed as well. But just in case, I'm going to be going over each of those things this week in order to fill in some of the blanks and make sure that you didn't miss anything. Plus, of course, I've got some more theories about where things are going and who certain people are actually working for and what their agendas might actually be. So if you still had too much buff out in your system, go grab that Addictol, because you're not going to want to miss any of this. Here we go. This is the first episode that opens up with a direct continuation of last week's cliffhanger, and instead of going to a flashback or something like that, we just get to see what happens with Lucy and the ghoul and the Deathclaw. That, by the way, I should have pointed this out last week, when the Deathclaw comes out of Gamora, which is, of course, one of the casinos, it stands up, and there are flames painted on the walls, and they keep talking about these Deathclaws as devils. And this one basically comes out of hell and stands up and scares our heroes. Or at least that's what the fire symbolism around it seems to imply. Turns out there's actually 3 male Deathclaws, by the way. And again, you can tell the gender by the direction the horns are facing. Front-facing, pointing horns, that means males. Back-facing horns, that means females. And the fact that we already saw some broken eggs implies that this was a nest at one point, and there might still be a mother Deathclaw around here somewhere. And later on in this episode, when they get to Freeside, somebody says that these Deathclaws moved into the area from Quarry Junction. Now, if you've played Fallout New Vegas, you know that Quarry Junction is just north of the area where you start and is along the path that's the shortest distance for you to get to the Strip, but it is infested with Deathclaws and a mother Deathclaw. And there's other things that go on there as well, including a quest line where you have to go find Deathclaw eggs for a character named Red Lucy. Now, does that play into how these Deathclaw eggs got to the Strip? Well, I don't know that we're sure yet. We could assume that they just moved in on their own. That may have been the case, but they would have needed to break down all the defenses that House had on the Strip in order to do so. So was there something else going on here? And as we know, not every character in Fallout is a reliable narrator, so I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Now, Dogmeat nopes out right away, runs underneath the little gate that they came through. And this leads to some logistics problems with the way this scene was shot. The gate they come through is not from Freeside, but it appears to be the same gate they exit through, which then leads to Freeside. I think that there were just some editing changes, or maybe some even scene changes, because now they're in the dark here, and then the next time we see them, it's like the middle of the day again, and they're standing looking at the gate that they just came out of. Now, were they standing there for hours? Did they take a nap and get back up? Probably not, but I'm guessing this was a post-production editing thing and they cut out some bits and pieces. And so there's a little bit of editing incontinuity. Is that a word? But it's really not a huge deal. The closer you look at any TV show, eventually you'll notice things like this. Another fun detail about the Deathclaws is that they had practical suits that they were using to puppet the Deathclaws around. That's part of why they look so good. Now, it's not just that they are practical. They are practical plus VFX. You have the person puppeting the suit, so the actors can actually react in real time to a 9-foot-tall costume that looks like a giant monster, and then they clean it up with VFX later in order to make sure that it fits directly in the scenery and everything looks as good as it possibly can. And I think the results are pretty solid here. These Deathclaws are formidable. And there's definitely a joke to be made here about when you follow the main quest line, but you don't go on any side quests, so your character doesn't level up enough to deal with some of the things they come across, and they hit them too soon, and then they have to find a way out of the situation. We've all been in that situation in a video game. And, well, the ghoul and Lucy make it out, but just barely. So now we're in Freeside, and you can tell that they followed so much of what is in the game directly in order to influence the way they built this little downtown looking area. You have a number of locations that show up in Fallout New Vegas. Now, they aren't in exactly the same locations. In fact, there isn't a welcome to the Vegas Strip kind of entryway that directly connects Freeside in this location to the Strip. It's not laid out exactly the same way in Fallout New Vegas, but the iconic landmarks are here, and I think that's the most important part. It doesn't really matter that, for example, the School for Impersonation, where the Kings were originally based, and we don't see any Kings, I don't think, in any of the footage here, so it implies that maybe they're all gone, maybe they are all feral, but that location in Fallout New Vegas doesn't actually lead directly to this gate. It's in fact on a very different side of Freeside. But that's not the only one. You can clearly see Mick and Ralph's, which was a location in New Vegas where you could buy weapons from Mick and you could also buy consumables from Ralph. We'll see in a little bit when the ghoul goes into the Wrangler Casino that that's here as well. And it does look a little different on the inside than it does in the game, but it feels close enough to me. Now here's one you may not have noticed. You can see behind the ghoul and Lucy as they're looking at the gate, golden globes, and then the final word gets cut off, but it clearly starts with a P-O, maybe an R, and then another letter. This is a location that does not show up in New Vegas. Underneath that, you can see adult books, XXX movies. This is the Golden Globes studio from Fallout 2. In Fallout 2, of course, we don't go to New Vegas, but you go to New Reno, and that's where this studio, we'll call it a movie studio, this movie studio was still functioning in the wasteland. Now, there's probably no chance we're going to New Reno anytime soon, so it's kind of a fun little Easter egg to drop this into Freeside. And who knows, maybe they opened up another location in Freeside and just, I don't know, used a lot of the same old signage and just moved it over from Reno. Who knows? But it is a fun callback. Plus, it does something that we wouldn't be able to do because of the Strip being kind of locked down and nobody's walking around in it. In Freeside, we see kind of first of all, it's busier than it is in New Vegas, but we also see a lot of different people walking around here, some of them wearing more typical wasteland clothing, the remnants of the pre-war clothes that might still be wearable but are absolutely destroyed. But then we also see characters who look like they fit into some of these vaults, people walking around who looked like they may have worked at Gamora at some point, which was similar to Golden Globes, a little bit more adult-focused for a casino. But then there's also people walking around with a variety of different outfit types. Some of them look like they were very fancy clothes. Some of them look like cowboys. You have this really interesting mix, and it seems to imply that the people who used to live on the Strip all now are in Freeside. So it's in the scene when we get this really interesting dialogue from Lucy. She says, "I'd ask why it is that my dad ran into a den of giant monsters, but you'd probably just tell me to shut the fudge up," she says to the ghoul. Now this, along with so many other things on the show so far that I've pointed out, has a double meaning. First of all, she seems to be thinking that her father would have run into the Strip itself, which is now occupied by these Deathclaws, these giant monsters, as if that would be his intent. But that would be weird, which it absolutely would be weird. We come to find out that Vault-Tec, based on the ghoul's research, has many of these special vaults for their employees, and he's been to a number of them and can't seem to find his wife and his daughter. And so he's now assuming that there must be another one of these below the Strip. But there's a double meaning here. Why would her father run into a den of monsters? Who's more monstrous than some of the corporations and individuals who led to the destruction of the world? People are the real monsters, is one of those common themes in these types of post-apocalyptic shows and movies and books. And due to some of the reveals in this episode, I'm starting to believe that more characters are actually working for the Enclave than I originally assumed. including probably Hank. But more on that in a little bit. Now, you'll notice that something's going on with the characters in this scene. Lucy is trying to get past the whole addiction thing. The ghoul recommends that she goes and get some Addictol from the store. He gives her some caps. He's being very nice to her here, which is not typical for him. So there's something going on. He's having some difficulties, and we can clearly see that by wanting to drink an entire bottle of alcohol. Now, later on the episode, we find out that his plan all along was to use Lucy as a bargaining chip with Hank in order to try to get his family back. But maybe there's more going on here. He seems to be warming up to her. And this is something that happens when you do nice things for other people. You start to actually like them more. It's a psychological thing. It's real. But my theory here is that her struggling with moral dilemmas, what is right and what is wrong, is something that he hasn't had to consider for so long that it's bringing him back, that the flashbacks we're seeing aren't just for us. They're things that he is reliving in his mind. He's thinking back through the events that have caused so much of the terrible things that happened in this world. And we'll see more of that in his conversation with House and how he handled these things. And I think he's starting to see that he wasn't just a victim of all of this, that he was a player and part of it all along. These scenes seem to be alluding to the fact that his internal emotional conflict is not just based on the fact that he was kind of fooled by Vault-Tec and became a face for their advertising and was a big part of what helped them grow in their popularity and bring people into vaults. I'm sure he has some regret about that, but there's probably something else going on as well, especially when House mentions that his calculations for the end of the world were shifted when he and Barb had their daughter. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Cooper heads into the Atomic Wrangler casino and sits down and gets a drink and then an entire bottle. And the bartender starts to have a conversation with him about not really caring about who's in charge as long as they don't tax him. And this is interesting because it, again, does two things. It reflects the mindset of many of these Wastelanders who feel like they don't ultimately have any real control about the powers who seem to lord over them, whether it's the NCR or the Legion or House. But it also echoes something else later. He had a very similar conversation with Mr. House, and then we see the ghoul look in the mirror as if he's seeing himself again for the first time, reflecting literally on who he has become. So this scene ends and we get a Galaxy News radio update. And this is great because this old graphic goes way back to like Fallout 1 and Fallout 2. And there's a reason for that. The Interplay Studios logo also had a orbiting rocket around a planet, well, Earth probably. And this is very similar. It's like they took the same style and design and they just made it work for Fallout. Now, this newsreel gives us a little update about all of these powerful corporations, Westech and Robco, Vault-Tec and the Big MT, are discussing the future of this country. And notice the ones that are put up on the screen here. House runs Robco, Vault-Tec, that one's obvious. Westech is responsible for the FEV, the Forced Evolutionary Virus, which we'll get to a little bit more later. And then Big MT. Fallout New Vegas has an entire expansion focused on Big MT, Old World Blues, and they are another one of these corporations that was doing unethical experiments on human beings, which seems to be a commonality among all four of these. Now, it's also in this episode where we come to finally get confirmation that the reason there are two houses is because one of them is a body double, which was something I speculated about earlier on in the season. Some people were arguing, no, that's House's brother. Nope. Definitely a body double, and he shows up in an image standing in front of what appear to be the legs of a giant robot, just like a picture that we get from Fallout New Vegas. Now, another little detail here, those giant legs are not exactly the same as Liberty Prime's giant legs, but Robco was definitely involved with the making of Liberty Prime, which was a giant robot that was contracted by the US government in order to serve in defense of the country and probably offense of against our enemies. But it never actually worked before the war because they had a hard time powering it. This was something that was solved at the end of Fallout 3. And then again in Fallout 4, we get to witness Liberty Prime stomping on communists or whatever it is that you pointed at. Now, maybe these legs in this picture were a prototype or another giant type of robot. Who knows what other machinations exist in the wasteland hidden in bunkers and places that nobody remembers anymore. And then we get the line in the advertisement where he says, "Where I come from, which is America, the house always wins." I almost expected it to be Las Vegas, but nope. But this echoes something that shows up in Fallout New Vegas. Now, as Coop and Barb are getting on the plane to Las Vegas, Hank is there as well. And Hank has chained to his wrist a box. It seems to be heavily implied that this is Cold Fusion. It's discussed at another point in the episode that they are training Cold Fusion for the bombs, or at least this seems to be what Moldaver thinks is happening here. And if Vault-Tec gets the bombs, then they can drop them. Now, younger Hank says that he is a target of assassination, which seems to imply, again, multiple things. If Hank is working for Vault-Tec and he's just carrying a very, very important item on him, then maybe there are people who know this and might be looking for him, and so therefore he feels endangered on the trip until he's in a place that's safer. Secondly, we know from the earlier episodes that he tries to contact somebody when he gets to this hidden vault. Now, I speculated that that was House himself, hoping House was still alive, and that maybe he had been working for House all along. I'm starting to think that Hank isn't actually working for Robert House. He's working for the Enclave, the shadow government behind the United States and many of these corporations. We know that Enclave members are seated throughout many of these corporations and in different levels of power, usually pretty high up. But that also means that not everybody at these corporations is also 100% in line with the Enclave. If some of the higher-ups at, say, Vault-Tec or Mr. House himself were to realize that the people that he had working for him or he was negotiating with had other intentions and were working for somebody else, then that would cause problems. And as we know, all of these individuals are pretty cutthroat. Now, Cooper ends up with a conversation with Moldaver just two phone booths away, and she, of course, is giving him what appears to be some sort of poison to use on House. She truly believes that if Cooper were to take out House, then that would solve the problem. But Cooper is not 100% sure about this and turns her down. This is a typical trolley problem where she says, what would be the problem with killing one person to save countless lives? And we get this really subtle situation where she says that the ends justify the means. And Cooper says that people have been saying stuff like that for years and then looks at Hank talking to two of Bud's buds, implying that this is exactly the same reasoning that Hank will use in the future in order to destroy Shady Sands and continue doing the other things that he's doing. Cooper knows that it's often justifications like this that lead to terrible decisions. In the next scene, Cooper is getting out of the car in Vegas with Barb. And on the way into the hotel, the casino, we see a few things happen. First of all, the song that's playing is Rags to Riches by Tony Bennett, which implies some of the ideas behind casinos, right? This idea that you could be a poor person and bet a little bit of money, but win a ton, and then all of a sudden you're rich. But I think it might also imply something else. This idea that, again, gets seeded later on in this episode, that somebody like Cooper Howard came from pretty much nothing. He grew up on a farm, and yet he has become very wealthy and also influential in ways that he doesn't expect. Now he runs into Mrs. Welsh, the U.S. representative, who seems to be fighting against all of the terrible things the United States government is doing here, and he kindly helps her stand back up. She laments that fighting the good fight is a series of humiliations, but then he says, keep at it, and she smiles at him. Now, this is the second time she's shown up, and the first time she shows up, it's kind of a goof. It not only confirms that people are not paying attention to the other people in America who seem to be a little bit more level-headed and sure about things going in the wrong direction, but that plays as a goof. And this, again, kind of plays as a goof. And normally in a show like this, in a script, you wouldn't seed a character like this into two separate scenes in two separate episodes with the same goof, unless that character is more important. Now, the more important bit might be reminding us that Cooper is on the same side as she is. They both want the best for America and don't want the bombs to drop or us to do terrible things. But it may also be more than that. Maybe she's a more important character, and the show is making sure that we definitely remember who she is by putting her in front of us a second time. So maybe she's more than she seems, maybe in a good way, maybe in a bad way. But I have a feeling we'll find out more about that soon. So Cooper goes in and, of course, gets summoned by Mr. House. We find out that the other Mr. House is a body double. We see the elevator up to the top of the tops, and Victor is there, echoing some of the things that were discussed when we saw the ghoul run into Victor previously. And House is sitting there in front of his gigantic CRT monitor, which, by the way, would have weighed something like 4,000 pounds and would have been basically impossible to make due to cathode ray technology only being able to create gigantic screens like that so big. But anyway, it doesn't matter if it's possible. It matters that it's incredible to look at and absolutely matches what it looks like in Fallout New Vegas. And House is sitting down there at his console, watching everything, including Cooper. He knows that Cooper was sent to kill him. He knows that he's a very important person. In fact, he was inside, or at least was able to detect things that were happening in his T-45 power armor back when he was in the war. And that's because although Westech created the power armor, Robco was still involved, kind of like with Liberty Prime. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Before we get to all of that, we have the chicken lover, or the snake oil salesman, whatever you would like to call him. And he's on his way to Las Vegas. He walks over a sign that says 50 miles. And then we get a scene of him with, well, let's call him a fan favorite, Fisto, while the music Luck Be a Lady Tonight plays, which seems to imply things. And then the conversation between them seems to make things pretty clear. And if you haven't played Fallout New Vegas, Fisto was a robot that was reprogrammed in order to be a, let's call it an adult companion, which is hilarious and terrifying all at the same time. Then the scene transitions back to Hank in his very special Vault-Tec management vault, I guess we'll just call it that. And you can see more of the cryogenic containers, including the names of Barb and Janie, implying that they are definitely in this vault. Well, we don't see their faces, though. And that's another movie and TV trick where you try to convince the audience of something, but then you don't fully confirm it. You know, like when somebody you think is dead because they fall off a cliff, but you don't actually see the body. Now, maybe they're there, or maybe they're not. We don't know 100%, but it does look like those cryo chambers are in use. So somebody's in there. Then the previous scene continues with the chicken lover who was hit on the head by Hank, now in the vault, and Hank has put the mind control device on the back of his neck, and they fake us out. They make us think that his head is going to explode again, and it doesn't. But why does it work? I think one thing that's implied is that Hank has continued to try to work on the technology and may have made a breakthrough. But I think that there's something else going on here as well. This individual was picked up from the wasteland because the experiments were not working on people he was waking up from cryogenic stasis. There's probably something going on with wastelanders that seems to make them more susceptible to the device. Was it the tough life that he lived? Is it all the drugs and things that he's done? Is it the idea that people in the wasteland have been irradiated more than regular people before the bombs dropped? Or there's the potential that FEV got out into the environment, which is a debated topic in the series, and maybe some people are slightly influenced by that and therefore slightly different evolutionarily than the humans who existed before the bombs dropped? Or is he more than he seems? I've seen some speculation out there, and there are a lot of people who are speculating things in order to kind of try to plug other stuff into the show, other lore that they would love to see show up, like the Enclave, who make synthetic people and replace them in the wasteland. Is this a synthetic human? Is that why this works? Because it's able to tap into his brain in a way that it doesn't work for regular humans. But I think this is a slim theory without a whole lot of credibility here, because usually there are better hints at these types of things that you in retrospect can look at and go, oh, that's definitely leading somewhere. I just missed it. In this case, especially with the conversation with Fisto, he just kind of implies that he's powered up and ready to go the same way that Fisto is, but it's not a really strong connection, in my opinion, because it seems to be implying that they're both robots. But one of the big things about synths is that they don't always know that they're robots unless they purposely leave the Institute and retain their memories, in which case maybe he's looking to get those things wiped, because that's one of the things that synths do, is they're happy to have their memories wiped sometimes so that they can live a brand new life and not have to fear or be bothered by the life that they left. It still feels a little tenuous to me. So then we get an update on Norm and the 31 vaulters. Well, I guess we'll just call them that. And they've made their way to a Vault Tech building where all of these people worked. And Ronnie points out that Janice is still at her desk because she was a kiss ass. One of the other guys responds with that. And it just goes to show how even these middle of the road Vault Tech employees from the pre-war are not empathetic at all. They find out that the place is now inhabited by Ma June and Barv, which every time they say that, I think it sounds like barf. And Ma June has a conversation with Norm. And what's important about this is that she thinks that Lucy is probably dead because she understands how dangerous the wasteland is. And she understands how naive all of these vault dwellers are. So she gives Norm the same advice. Go back to your vault. You're not safe. But even when leaving the scenario here, she mentions that she's trying to be a better person, which implies that Lucy and her attitude about trying to be a good person seems to have made a difference. Then we jump to Lucy and she's in the store trying to, she finds a way to sneak her way in, and the guy behind the desk goes upstairs and she steals some Addictol because it's so expensive. She definitely can't afford it. Then she steals a Power Fist, which is a weapon that's been in the series for a long time and is a lot of fun to use when you're doing a melee build. And then she notices there's a body in the garbage and the guy behind the counter has clothes that don't fit, and she murders him in self-defense, but she still murders him. Now, she's still under the effects of buff out, so it's not 100% her fault, but this is the first time she's acted lethally towards another living person. And the scene is set up in a way where we understand that he's a bad guy. He's not a good person, so we don't lament this too much. Also, he was about to attack her and kill her, so it is self-defense. But it's enough to show that she might be going too far, and she starts to realize that. So in this episode, both Lucy and the ghoul are coming to a realization about who they are and who they've become, and also how what seem to be little tiny decisions can lead to bigger problems. So then we flash back to Cooper and his conversation with Mr. House, and some interesting things are revealed here. First of all, Mr. House has been tracking everything. That's his goal, to know everything. And he claims that he's been calculating the date of the end of the world based on all of these different variables. But there are some hidden variables that he's been struggling with. One seems to be Cooper and why the birth of his daughter changed the equation. And then he goes on about how there's still another variable that he's unsure about, which I think is implying the Enclave, because they've done a really good job of acting from behind the scenes so far in influencing the government and influencing these other corporations without actually revealing themselves to be a hive mind that's in control. Now, I've seen some pushback online in just the few hours it's been since I've watched the show and have been working on this recording, that people are saying that, well, of course, you can't calculate the end of the world. He's putting too much trust on this. Cooper is right. He is insane. And you have to remember that there's a very fine line between genius and insanity. And in Fallout New Vegas, we find out that he was correct about the date the bombs would drop within 20 hours, less than a day. It happened sooner than he expected, and so he wasn't 100% ready, but he was still really, really close. So something he was doing to calculate this date actually worked. So in this scene, I don't think we should consider him to be an unreliable narrator or somebody who's gone off the deep end, who is just hallucinating these ideas or something like that. Sure, he seems kind of crazy. And yeah, he's a megalomaniac who wants control of things and doesn't trust other people. He believes he's smarter than everyone else. And most of the time, he probably is. And in this scene, I think it absolutely is telling us that there is something else going on. Why is the birth of Janie so important? And I have a guess here. A new year means colder days, and colder days means that your wardrobe has to hold up. And maybe you're craving a winter reset, something that will last season to season. Well, Quince brings together premium materials, thoughtful designs, and enduring quality, so you can stay warm, look sharp, and feel your best all season long. And Quince has everything you need: Mongolian cashmere sweaters, wool coats, leather and suede outerwear. And last time I talked about Quince, I mentioned the suede pants I picked up, and I have been wearing them so much. They're super comfortable for just wearing around the house, but I've worn them out in the cold weather, and they're both way more comfortable and warmer than jeans. It's probably because of the premium materials made from trusted factories, but also, they're not as expensive as they look. Quince is basically a luxury brand at a fraction of the price, with classic styles that will hold up year after year. So what about you? Are you looking for a new jacket, a coat, pants like I got? Quince is the place to go find all the things that you need. And right now, you can refresh your winter wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/falloutlore for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/falloutlore. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/falloutlore.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offering, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-FOR Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
It's not because Janie did something. She's a child, or she was a child when the bombs dropped. It's because had she not been there, Cooper or Barb or both of them would have made different decisions. And this is something every parent knows. You live your life a certain way when you are single, and then you get married, and you still mostly live your life the same way. You have a certain level of, well, willing to risk things because it's just you, or it's just you and a spouse. But once you have children, your decisions change. You start making decisions less about yourself and more about your family and the well-being of your children. And so this is going to change things. And we see a scene right at the end after Cooper is drunk and he's laying on the bed and Barb is trying to help him feel better where he says, "We need to talk." And that might be the moment on this day where the birth of their child causes them to have a conversation that they otherwise would never have had. This also does something else. One of the patterns we've seen with Cooper and the ghoul is that he is basically not very good at having conversations with people. He doesn't answer questions. He implies a lot of things. He holds a lot of his feelings in. He is not a good communicator. And many of the problems in his life, both before the war and after the war, seem to come from the fact that he could have done a better job simply communicating with the people that he cared about or the people that he was working with. But in this scene, right at the end of the episode, he is attempting to actually communicate with his wife. And this may have changed the world. Now, another fun detail in the scene is that we see House put on this weird device on top of his head. This is the same exact device that we find on his deteriorating body in New Vegas when we come across him. He's basically stuck in a chamber with a device on his head. And people have been asking about this online. My assumption here is that that device is a brain link directly to the machinery that is eventually going to keep him alive, but also keep him in control of all of the technology, all of the robots, all of that. It may have been part of how he was able to experience what the power armor suit was doing was through this mental interface. Now, he also mentions in the scenes where he's talking with Cooper that his plan is to survive the bombs dropping, which is exactly what he does in New Vegas. He sets up a defense grid and is able to keep most of Vegas protected, including himself. But in this dialogue, he mentions that he will do this by becoming basically an automaton, by putting his mind inside the technology, not by keeping his body alive. But we know that that's not actually the case once we get to the events of New Vegas. He is able to maintain his body, although in a very deteriorated and kind of weak state. So maybe he had some sort of technological update that allowed him to do that. But what I think is more likely is the fact that because he was wrong about the date the bombs were going to drop, he wasn't able to interface early enough to transfer his mind fully into the computers. And so he had to get into a pod, which was probably his backup plan, because he has plans upon plans upon plans, in order to preserve himself when the bombs dropped, in order to control the defense of the city. And he realized that that was good enough, or he just ended up stuck there. So maybe his initial plan was to transfer his mind completely into the computers, but ended up still being a biological entity. And I'm not 100% on this. I'm sure there are multiple ways you could probably interpret this. I think the worst way is probably, oh, the writers messed up and they missed something. But I don't know. I think that there's probably more going on here, and there's always more details. And again, plans upon plans upon plans with Robert House. So we go back to Norm, and he is uncovering what's actually going on with Vault-Tec and the phrase Future Enterprise Ventures, which I did miss on the last episode. I didn't have subtitles up, but a lot of people on the internet caught that Future Enterprise Ventures matches FEV, Forced Evolutionary Virus, which raises a lot of questions. Are they planning to turn the people in the vaults into super mutants? I don't think that that's likely. Norm finds the computer, logs in, puts in Future Enterprise Ventures into the Vault-Tec system, and it does not return anything, which either implies that it didn't exist at all, or that he just didn't have the clearance to get to that information. But then it recommends that, well, it's similar to FEV, which would have been documented by Vault-Tec, because as we know, they are aware of all of the different experiments happening in all of the vaults, and they are connected to these other corporations, and they are aware of a lot of the things that they're doing. Also, the FEV was a response to the plague that happened and an attempt to fight the plague. So there's a long story about how FEV evolved and changed over time and why it was being used to make super mutants and all of that. But what we know more about FEV than anything is that it was designed and used by West-Tec and in cooperation with the US government in order to make super mutants. It was not leveraged by Vault-Tec to do so. So you add together the fact that Future Enterprise Ventures does not show up in their computer system, and Ronnie was the personal assistant to Bud, and Hank was the assistant to Barb, and now you have assistants who may have been planted into Vault-Tec by the Enclave. And in my mind, this perfectly lines up. Ronnie was there in order to make sure that he furthered the will of the Enclave with Bud, who is an important person at Vault-Tec. Hank was there because he was pushing Enclave's agenda with Barb. And we're getting more and more proof that Vault-Tec were not the ones who dropped the bomb, although in the previous season, we saw that that was something they were considering doing. And a lot of the fan base jumped on top of that. They were like, oh, we know who dropped the bombs. And I kept saying, we don't know. We know that they had a plan to possibly do that, but we don't know that they actually did it. And more evidence seems to be pointing to the fact that the Enclave was behind all of this. Sure, there are individuals who work at each of these corporations that are terrible human beings, that lack any empathy for other people, that are megalomaniacs like House who want to take control of things and believe they're the only one with the right answer. But the real villain behind all of this, the wars that happened before the bombs dropped, the Death Claws, the super mutants, West-Tec and Vault-Tec being manipulated, all of this points back to the Enclave, and it's a puzzle that House has been trying to solve because he still doesn't quite know who exactly the Enclave is. So then we end up with the big final scene. Lucy returns to the ghoul at the Wrangler, and we find that the chicken guy, the snake oil salesman, has been fully controlled by Hank and issues a bargain. Basically, he says that the ghoul needs to take Lucy back to her vault. Otherwise, he will never see his family again. But now the ghoul has confirmation about where his family is, or at least seems to, if Hank is telling the truth here. And before we get to how this plays out, think about what this implies about the vaults having something to do with super mutants. Why would Hank, if he knows about Future Enterprise Ventures, which we're not 100% sure about, but he probably does, want Lucy to go back to the vault if they're planning to turn all of those people into super mutants? So either he doesn't know about Future Enterprise Ventures, which would mean that he isn't actually on the same side as Bud, or at least as informed as Bud was about what was going on, which is possible, but seems unlikely to me. Or the Enclave wasn't planning to use the FEV on these vaults, or at least not everyone in the vaults. There's something else going on here, and I'm not 100% sure about it yet, so if you have some theories, let me know. So we see the ghoul tranquilize Lucy, and I think there are two potentials here. First is he completely gives in and he realizes that he needs his family and he's willing to do something terrible in order to make sure that he gets them back, because that was the plan all along. But he seems to have had second thoughts about that throughout this episode. That seems to be his dilemma. The scene with him drinking a bunch and then flashing back to Mr. House and drinking a bunch. There are parallels here. He's realizing that he might have to do something terrible in order to get what he wants, and he's struggling with that. And as I mentioned before, he has more influence over the events that have happened than he seems to have expected. It's as if he's reacting to things, and then things play out in ways that are way bigger and way worse than he ever would have expected. And there's visual symbolism here with him drunk on the back of not a bull, but a bomb, riding it at the casino, as if he is trying to somehow control or stay on the back of this deadly thing that is about to change the world forever. It feels kind of like he's back on that bomb, or maybe has never left it, symbolically. Now Lucy drops to the floor and we think that she's about to pass out. He tells her to go to sleep and then she'll wake up where she came from. But then she gets back up. Now, tranquilizers can take a little while before they fully work on somebody, but I also think that this might have something to do with the fact that she has Addictol in her system, which could be fighting the tranquilizer. I don't know. It's just some speculation on my side. Then she punches him out a window with the power fist, and we see him get impaled on a pole. So Norm's story ends with him getting choked out by Ronnie, who discovers that he's not actually in charge. Lucy passes out, and the ghoul ends up impaled on a pole. So we have the biggest cliffhanger yet, because three of our favorite characters are now in trouble. Now, you don't have to worry too much. We've seen scenes in the trailers that show that the ghoul is still alive throughout the rest of this season. So being impaled on a pole is not enough to kill him. How he will heal from that, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it might have something to do with the power core that the chicken lover still has from negotiating with Thaddeus when he gave Thaddeus what was probably FEV that's turning him into a super mutant. Remember, we saw a scene previously where he used a power core and the radiation from the power core to heal himself. That could happen again. So don't worry, he's not dead, but we're not really sure what's going to happen with Norm. Will he be turned into a super mutant? What else could possibly happen, being a prisoner of these Vault Tech people who have no idea what the world is like yet? And what's going to happen with Lucy? I think what they're setting up here is the fact that the ghoul will be incapable of taking her back to the vault, so Hank will have no choice other than to bring her to him. And the scene that we haven't seen yet, with the ghoul and Maximus and Thaddeus approaching the gate in order to go into the strip again or deal with the death claws, is not them getting ready to defend Freeside. No, it is them coming together in order to fight the death claws to get back to wherever Lucy is being held to try to rescue her. I have a feeling that that is the big climactic scene of the season. So there you go. Those are my thoughts so far. All the things I remembered to bring up. I'm sure I will have other thoughts today and other things that come up that I'll want to clarify in the next episode. So make sure you stay tuned for that. And as always, if you have any thoughts about any of the stuff we've seen so far, or you have a counterpoint to one of my points with some really interesting evidence, absolutely let me know. Comment on the episode, or better yet, join us on the Robots Radio Discord. There's a link in the description and in the main description of the show as a whole, or just search Robots Radio Discord. You'll find a link on Google. That's the best place, because the spoiler section on our Discord has been so busy lately. Everybody with their theories and their different thoughts and their perspectives. And on top of it, it is such a wonderful community. Everybody is so polite. And even when we disagree with things, we do it in a kind of an academic way where there's no personal attack. It's more of a, well, that's interesting, but what do you think about this sort of way? It's the best Discord on the internet as far as I'm concerned. But I'll be back in a second. We got to go thank our patrons. Don't go anywhere. This show wouldn't be possible without our patrons. Thank you so much for your continued support. And welcome to the Main Monkey, our newest patron and Sentry Bot. So now, Main Monkey, you get shoutouts every week, along with Germinator and Era. Thank you so much for your support. If you'd like to help make sure that this show keeps on going, then please join me, patreon.com/falloutlorecast. You can get ad-free episodes, so you can listen back through all of the episodes without any ad interruptions if you're new to the show. But you can also join us on the Patreon chat, which is coming up, the next one in the next 2 weeks. And I'm sure we'll be discussing what happened in episode 7. I think it'll be 7 by that week. Plus, where we think the season's going to end. And maybe we'll do some fun predictions and we'll see if any of our patrons can nail the ending. That'll be super fun. Also, if you'd like to help out in other ways, leave a 5-star review or a comment. A positive comments and reviews are extremely helpful. And if you leave one on Apple, then I'll read it out on a future episode of the show. And the ones on Apple, even if you don't listen on Apple, if you just have an account, you can do it. And they're super helpful because those are the ones that get proliferated across the internet. So when people look up just general reviews on Google or whatever, those are the reviews that show up. So that would be super helpful. Thank you so much for all of your support. And if you have friends or family who are enjoying the TV show and they want to delve deeper in it and be able to listen while they're at work or driving in a car, this is the show for them. Please recommend the Fallout Lorecast to all of your friends and family. Thanks again for being here. I'll be back next week with more details, and I can't wait for the next episode. And much like Robert House, I can predict that that will happen in the future, about exactly a week from when this happened. I'm a genius. Can you tell? All right. See you next time. To plug into everything else we're doing, check out robotsradio.net. Reach out to me on Twitter at robots_radio. Check out the Robots Radio Rocket Club, where you can join me and a bunch of our other creators creating your podcast, starting a new podcast, or helping your current podcast grow. There's more information about that on robotsradio.net as well. And you can always talk with us and the entire community, over 2,000 people, on the Robots Radio Discord. Come join us. We'd love to chat with you. See you guys next time. Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM. Make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.